You are listening to a sermon by Henry Neufeld, recorded on Sunday, February 14, 2016, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
When I prepare something to say, I usually give it to Tina to read. I asked her what she thought of the sermon, and she shrugged her shoulders and said it was okay. She's shaking her head. So if it's mediocre, you have been warned. John Milton's epic poem, Paradise Lost, was written in the 1600s, and it recounts the creation story, the battle of the angels, and Adam and Eve's expulsion from Eden, hence the title, Paradise Lost. A Quaker, Thomas Elwood, who was living in Milton's day, read Paradise Lost and said to Milton, "Thou hast said much here of Paradise Lost, but what hast thou to say of Paradise Found?" And hearing this, Milton, who was blind at the time, dictated Paradise Regained, a much shorter book, an account of Jesus' three temptations in the wilderness. The Quaker's comments were a turning point for Milton. As we enter the Lenten season, we want to consider a major turning point in Jesus' life. Jesus left his carpenter work and was baptized by John, as Evan talked about a few weeks ago. And almost immediately, he went on a 40-day fast in the wilderness. Well, he didn't just go to the wilderness. The Spirit drove him there. And for Jesus, baptism and the wilderness were major turning points. And after his wilderness experience, he gathered about a dozen disciples with him, and he went about healing people. And they went back to Nazareth. He went home again. And in his village, he reads the scripture, and then he comments on the scripture, and that gets him into trouble. Well, in small towns and rural areas, everybody knows something about almost everybody else. And on returning home, one might be viewed with skepticism or welcomed as a hero. And heroes, especially athletes and those people who do well financially, are often celebrated and welcomed. How has this person changed since he's been away? Does he think he's better than we are? Is he still one of us? There are some classic attitudes of small towns and rural attitudes and rural areas. A few weeks ago, Janice asked Heather Murray what she liked about living in Chilliwack. She mentioned, among other things, "I grew up there. I go to the same church. I know everyone." Now that's an advantage and a liability. Knowledge and stories about other families are common. They get passed around, they get elaborated, and they become community and village gossip. Nicknames and reputations get attached to people, and they're hard to extinguish. When I was doing child welfare work in rural Manitoba, including amongst the Mennonites in southern Manitoba, first question I would often get is, "Which Neufeld family are you from?" And I was very pleased to be able to say, "I'm from BC." And the disappointment was obvious. Not because I was from BC, but because people couldn't peg me or ascribe any particular characteristics to me based on my family background. They didn't have any stories about my family. And these names and reputations, they stick for generations and become part of small-town folklore. Now, presumably, Jesus lived at home till he was about 30 years old. He left home in a drastic manner. Now, leaving home is important. It's an important part of becoming an independent adult. and young people today have a variety of ways of leaving home. Some go to Bible school, go to university, they do volunteer work, or they travel. The important thing is that they leave. Leaving home broadens one's horizons, and returning home can be a challenge. Jesus returns and teaches in the synagogue. He reads the passages that we have heard, and so far so good. Then he gives a discourse on what the words mean and how they were being fulfilled. And he makes several points. Isaiah's prophecy is now finally coming true. Jesus, he was the one anointed with the Spirit as described by the prophet. And the time of God's salvation has arrived. Now, Nazareth was a village of about 200 people. He was well known there, and he faced the small town attitudes. The initial reception was positive. Everyone was amazed. But then things turned sour, and small town views kicked in. The people could not believe that Jesus, a carpenter, could be teaching in the synagogue. Is he crazy? Or is he just a lot smarter than we realized? We know this guy. He's Mary's son. Where does he get all this stuff? We've known him since he was a kid. We know his brothers and his sisters live here. Now, to refer to him as Mary's son is a derogatory comment because he should be referred to as Jacob's son. Joseph's. Sorry, that was close. And it's interesting, in the two gospel texts we have, one says he's Mary's son, and the other says he's Jacob's son, or Joseph's son. So what happened was that people thought they knew Jesus. He couldn't have changed that much. Or they won't allow him to change. They won't let him out of the family box. Small communities have ways of pegging people, putting them in boxes, and not letting them out. And then they get upset. Disdainfully, they ask, who does he think he is? How did he get so wise all of a sudden? And what made the people of Nazareth angry was Jesus' comments on the text. They got angry because Jesus pointed out two stories from their scriptures that they didn't really like. In Elijah's day, there were many widows in Israel. Yet, after 3.5 years of drought, God sends Elijah to a widow in Sidon, not to an Israeli widow. And it's a fascinating story because Elijah goes to the widow. He meets her at the city gate. She's gathering sticks for a fire. And he asked her to bring him some bread. And she said, look, all I've got is a little bit of flour, a little bit of oil, enough for my son and me. We're going to eat this and we're going to die. And he says to her, don't worry about it. You're going to have enough flour. And he lives with her for a while. There's always enough flour, enough oil, always enough to eat. So then the other story gets worse. Because God sends a prophet to Naaman. Now there were many lepers in Israel. Yet God sends a healing prescription to Naaman, a Syrian, not an Israeli. These words cause problems, big problems. All the people could think about it was that Jesus is telling them that they were below the Gentiles. God helped the Gentiles, not his chosen people. They didn't like these stories. They didn't want to hear them. And they're angry because he's insistent on the fact that unless they see themselves as no better than a Syrian leper, no better than a pagan Gentile woman, unless they see themselves as no better than outcasts, they aren't going to get saved. Jesus, a lifelong Jew, a teacher, one of their own, says, you're no better off than a pagan. You're no better off than a Gentile leper. These are unthinkable and unkind comments, and they hurt because the people are committed to self-righteousness. After all, they have a special claim on God. He's their God. And I'm reminded of a current situation at Wheaton College, where in December a professor wrote that Christians and Muslims have the same God. And she was suspended for making that comment. And this past week, there's a news release that she and Wheaton College agreed to part ways. People were upset. This is our God. It's very much like the people in Jesus' day. You can't have him. It's our God. If you want to know more about this, talk to Curtis. What Jesus has dared to tell the chosen people that God has a right to do as he pleases. God selected unclean Gentiles rather than his chosen people. But he's our God. He can't do that. He's our private, personal God. We are his chosen people. Well, God chose to heal non-Jews. So they turned on him and they ran him out of town. One of the Gospels says that the rougher element among the villagers tried to kill him. Well, then there's a problem with Jesus being unable to perform miracles. Scripture says he couldn't do any miracles except heal a few people. Well, healing a few people to me sounds like a miracle. But a miracle is more than just an event. It's also a perceived event. If Jesus is not regarded as capable of healing, any healing will probably not be attributed to him. People would say it happened in spite of him. It couldn't have been anything he did. Well, Jesus couldn't get over their stubbornness. In essence, they tripped over what little they knew about him, and they never got any further. And that's a telling comment. They never got any further. They were stuck with their perceptions of Jesus and his family from years ago. They had him in a box, and they weren't going to let him out. Well, that comment could be made by a lot of people who left their community and returned. And they tripped over what little they remembered about him. Frederick Buchner describes an image of Jesus standing in the church, in church services all over Christendom. His hands are tied behind his back. He is unable to do any mighty works, because people either don't expect him to do mighty works, or they don't dare ask him to do them. Jesus said, a prophet has little honor in his hometown or among his relatives. Remember that Jesus' family at one time thought he was crazy. Their low expectations, their preconceptions, and their closed minds all rendered Jesus powerless. Jesus told them that God had a right to dispense his favors as he pleased. And in doing so, God often selected the most unlikely objects. They didn't like this. The doctrine of free grace was a stumbling block to them. Well, some questions I want to leave with you. What was your experience of leaving home and returning? What was your wilderness experience, and how did it change you? What were the major turning points in your life? In thinking about communion, I want to talk a bit about the cross. Jesus told us that we were supposed to take up our cross and follow him. I used to think that the cross, was a difficult situation that was somehow forced upon us. Either an illness in a family member, a difficult spouse, financial problems, a miserable colleague, these were crosses. But I've come to think of the cross as a choice. Jesus says, take up a cross. That is a choice we make. It's a choice he made. Jesus had options, but he chose the cross. A cross we take up is a decision that costs us something in terms of time, money, energy, or reputation. So the question for us in this Lenten season is, what costly decisions have I made that go beyond giving up chocolate? What is the costly act that I need to do? So I encourage you in this Lenten season to make a costly decision, a decision that will cost you something.